Hi, I'm Loiso Madinga.
And I'm Gail Galley.
And this is a special bonus series of An Idiot's Guide to Saving the World, the podcast for anyone who cares about building a better world but doesn't know where to start.
We are on a mission to get everybody on board to achieve the global goals. There are 17 goals that the world has promised to deliver by 2030. And we spent our last two series exploring what they are and then what needs to change. Now that we're officially halfway to the 2030 deadline, we are not halfway to achieving them. So it's time for some bright ideas about the future.
So recently we held an event in New York City where we invited some incredible politicians, filmmakers, business leaders, and activists to share some thoughts about how we can steal the win in the second half.
And over three episodes, we've been chatting to some of them again to get everybody as inspired as we were.
Today, we're talking to two leaders who are heading up two very different organizations, both of which are playing an important role in driving action that benefits the planet.
I'm speaking to Jesper Brodin, the man who has transformed Flatpak furniture giant IKEA into a circular, sustainable business model. He is encouraging other businesses to do the same.
Honestly, I feel sorry for the companies out there who haven't understood that. Because if you're not on the train by now, you will have high cost. You will have brand damage. If you're not on the train, you better hurry up.
And I'll be speaking to Gloria Walton, CEO of the Solutions Project, about why learning from frontline communities is at the heart of her organization's fight for climate justice.
It is the intersectional issue of our time. And so we have an ability to tackle racism, poverty, and pollution and build a better, healthier world.
Hi, Loiso.
Hi, Gail. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. And today, we're going to be speaking to some people with power, which always makes me feel, nervous, but also like, let's step into it. Because whether they are at the top of a huge company or someone in charge of a charity or an NGO, you can't deny it. People at the top have a responsibility to lead the change in the second half when it comes to making our businesses work better for the planet.
That's one of those words that's become a bit of a dirty word, hasn't it? Power.
Yeah.
But we forget that it's something that we could all have, I guess. But it's, I think we've just started being a bit dubious about those who clearly have it.
Yeah, it's bad, isn't it? Why? Because power in itself means energy. If you think about the original etymology, so that's not a problem. Is it because power has become associated with the patriarchy, you know, with exploitation?
All of it. The history of power, colonialism and patriarchy and all the documentaries we've watched over the years of all the corporations and all the money and all the abuse. That's what it's associated with. And we forget that it just means the ability to do anything you have the ability to do is power. I think even just recognizing your power is power. But we don't. Every day we're just like, what I can't do. And oh, what should be done? And I don't know what to be done about the thing.
Is that how you start most of your days?
That's how I start my day.
Is it?
And it's weird. It's weird for my four-year-old. But she has to listen.
Oh, no. Daddy's crying again about how he's got no power.
It's the morning weeps, mother. It's the morning weeps. But yeah, I think it's a word that we've limited the amount of people who can have it, but it's a word that anybody can have.
But it does make you think about the role of business in society. You know, when you think of something like Twitter or Apple, you know, Google, these are all massive businesses, but they have massive footprints in the world and they have customers. And I sort of think there's two sides of the power argument there. There's what the businesses do has a huge impact on the world, depending on what it chooses to do with its resources and its reach and its products. But then the consumer's got the power as well. Because frankly, at some point we could all just go, I'm not buying that anymore because I don't believe the business behind it is aligning with my values. I don't know that people know or feel their power as consumers in the world.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I'm like, it's not to put blame on anybody solely. It's not just the businesses, it's not just the people, because the businesses will also provide whatever we're willing to buy. That's just the economics of it. But we also sometimes feel bogged down by our options and we don't know that we can demand better. And we don't know that we're voting with our money. But it's about becoming more conscious of our decision, I guess. It's like really knowing that every decision we make matters. And I think that kind of education of kind of gives you the power also. Education is power is what I'm trying to say.
Education is power. And I think if you think about it, so education is a global goal, number four. I was just remembering the last few times that we've been out and about with the Goals House, seeing MasterCard talk about goal number 12, responsible consumption, because they have 2 billion cardholders in the world. So that's 2 billion opportunities to educate people about the purchase that they're making. So it's wild. If you think about them just deciding to step into this, which they have, that means that they are going to be able to potentially affect 2 billion people's understanding of the power of what it is they're choosing to buy, which makes me really excited. And it also brings us on to our guest, Jesper Brodin. He runs one of the biggest retailers in the world, IKEA. I don't know if you've heard of that, Louisa? Ever tried to assemble
murmurs
a wardrobe?
Here and there.
Yeah. But I've met him a few times and he was so good at our dinner. And I'm really glad to hear from him about what he thinks he can do as the leader of that business, because how do you run such a huge international business and keep the climate concerns right at the heart of all your decision making? So Jesper Brodin, welcome to the podcast. For most people, they will have heard of you in terms of IKEA, right? So you work for you run the IKEA, the Inca Group, of which IKEA is a part, right? Mm-hmm. But we had Johan Rockström on this podcast in our first season, and he said something that I've hung on to, which is, we have turned the corner. Like, there is no question, right? Yeah. Businesses like yours, policies, we know that we have to end fossil fuels. Are we running fast enough now that we've turned the corner? That was his challenge. So thinking about that from an enormous player like IKEA, which I get excited about thinking about your scale, how did that start for you? Mm-hmm. Did you have an aha moment where you thought, okay, this is what we must do? Or was that always there for as long as you've been running things?
Well, you can say I've had a couple of aha moments. I think my first one was actually not so much planetary, but more on the people side. Way back in a different century when I started, 95, I was part of the
supply
chain.
You must be you can't be a day over 30, Jesper. Come on.
I had actually the opportunity to learn, as we were basically starting up the purchasing operations in Asia, that being a good business and doing good business is synonymous. So we had at that time some worries about cost and how we would apply our values and such. And it turned out, it's a long story, but it turned out to be the opposite, right? When it comes to wake-up call, I actually think The Inconvenient Truth, then I got it. And I watched it a couple of times. And that's when I committed, because this is not a side event, this is the core event. But then I think in IKEA it's a collective of people that have been, including the foundation, who is the owner. There's a deep belief and commitment to that this is both ethically right, brand right, and business right. And actually the last part is one of the great myths still out there, that sustainability or climate would be damaging to your business, to your P&L, to your cost and so on. It's absolutely the opposite. And I feel sorry for the companies out there who haven't understood that. Because if you're not on the train by now, you will have higher cost, you will have brand damage, and you might lose out in relations with future co-workers and whatnot. So if you're not on the train, you better hurry up.
That's a really nice way of putting it. And I also think what you can create as a business evangelist, because I think that's what you are, really. You go around a lot of these conferences. You must take a lot of time to spread that message. But I think if someone sees a business such as IKEA, so big, so successful, telling them that, you know, they're going to miss the train if they don't jump, I think that's wildly exciting.
Yeah. Hey, you need to bring the facts also. I have to say that, because it's truly interesting. We reported last year growth since Paris by 25% in IKEA.
Wow.
24.6 something. And we reported an absolute carbon, not relative, but absolute carbon of minus 13.6. So there you go. That's one proof that growth and decarbonization is smart. Renewable energy has lowered our cost and made us independent. A switch to reducing food waste or plant-based food, etc., has reduced cost, increased our business. You know, so the myth that this would cost money or that people would pay for it, we need to combat somehow.
And I suppose what you've said there is, because this is true of a customer as it is a business leader, isn't it? It's not necessarily going to cost more to make more sustainable choices. Can you talk a bit to that? Has that always been the belief in IKEA, or have you had to convince people of that?
Well, I think we still also, of course, we still hit some areas where it's almost like three buckets, the low-hanging opportunities, things that you need to work a bit on. Then we have a couple of things that we scratch ahead. And until 2030, we have a few material areas where technology and industry will maybe not be up and running. So we need to make sure the totality moves. But the interesting thing, I think, is The opposite would be an unreasonable thought, because waste is cost. And also, if you look at the latest data, we interview 33,000 people every second year. So it's 30 markets across the globe. It's a good database, actually, yeah, for ordinary people. And interesting enough, now we're close to 70% of people in the world, regardless of market, very little variance between China, US, Sweden, and so forth, that are deeply concerned, actually quite updated, knowledgeable,
okay,
and motivated to actually be part of the solution. And they expect us to do more, inform more. And the only difference, I would say, that stands out is when you go down in age groups, it's up in the 90s, the worry. But also, unfortunately, in that age group, it's also we have massive trust issues growing. So I think, again, we need to speed up and we need to be much more vocal on our commitments and our plans and our actions.
I've heard you talk about young people before as a positive driver for your business and for your business strategy. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast are quite young, younger than us, unbelievably.
That's why we don't have a camera here.
Exactly. What advice would you give them in terms of giving business, a kick up the, as it were, so that they all behave as IKEA are behaving and actually push IKEA to continue to behave even better? Because I know you want that.
I think we underestimate the collective power. So I think the power of purchase, to start with, raise your voice, put your money in with the companies and the brands that you trust. And I don't think it's a matter of perfection at this moment. We are into a very difficult transformation, the whole world. And as you said before, we're actually doing okay. We need to speed up, we need to do more, but we have proof points enough that this is working. But I think to not lose hope and not to underestimate the power of what we can do collectively.
Yeah, well, that's a nice lead into my final question while we've got you, about the global goals and how we're going to win that second half. So we met in New York, didn't we, last, at a dinner all about that with Mayor Khan and the wonderful Kelly Nascimento, and fantastically inspiring speakers, all giving us tips on how do you change your tactics or shake it up for the second half, because we're halfway to the global goals, but we haven't anywhere near progressed as much as we should have done at halftime. What would you say to people who are struggling with something? How would you change it up to step up the progress?
To start with, I think we have enough proof points that it's working. The transformation has started. It is about hope also. We need to infuse hope in this. But I think it's also about calling out the elephants in the room. So if you look at, for instance, we need to basically phase out fossil fuel as soon as possible. And as we do that, continue to rapidly speed up the alternatives, which looks great, by the way, renewables. But there are a couple of things we shouldn't postpone or be too philosophical about. It's about taking action.
It's about taking action. That is sums up IKEA to me in a word. Action. They are really on the move. What did you think about that, Luso?
Oh, I really enjoyed, one, how he was ballsy enough, because you have to be, if you're in the corporate world and you say into a microphone that you want oil to be phased out, it takes some balls in this world. But two, I think my favorite thing about that, what excites me, is what I'm currently excited about, which is the idea of good is profitable. And I think for a long time it was seen as good is not profitable, good is more, it takes more. We've moved away from all of that because, you know, the old world wasn't making money, it wasn't profitable, and now you're taking us back to making things, you know, the hard way, or don't take things, don't mass produce, or what, all these things that have come out from the corporate world that we know now. But he's saying, no, our proof point is that it's profitable. Like, I think that's my current obsession with sustainable farmers, is that I enjoy how they love to stand on the edge of a fence and show the difference, to go, look at our land, look at our neighbor's land. And the neighbors looked at us and say, you're crazy. There's no way you can farm like this. And they're showing their neighbors, like, hey, I'm making money now because I don't have to put in all the inputs that you do and you've been convinced with. And changing those paradigms and being the proof point, that's the hard part. And to have gotten corporations to the point where it's like, no, it's possible and it's profitable, that's huge. That's really huge. Because now, what's your excuse as a corporation?
Yeah, right. I mean, if someone's telling you it's better for the planet and it's better for your business, you'd be mad not to, right? I think his example is so relevant to us as we embark upon the second half, because we are really far behind with a lot of those goals and the world has gotten a lot harder since 2015. And yet, with ambition and belief, we might get there. And I think what IKEA have set out to do with ambition and belief is to turn themselves into a better company, which is more profitable by doing the right thing. And it seems that they're doing that. So I take from him, let's be really bold in the second half and we can make it work. Anyway, that's what I took out of it. Who have we got next? Because I wasn't there. Who's our next guest, Loiso?
Yes, Gloria Walton, who is CEO and president of the Solutions Project, which funds climate justice solutions created by frontline communities to work towards a fairer world. She works at the intersection of climate, race, and gender issues. And recently, she was awarded the Time CO2 Earth Award, which is a biggie. So how do you lead an organization that is committed to making the world a better place? And what does she think we need to do next? Let's find out.
I'm Gloria Walton, and I'm the CEO and president of the Solutions Project. And we're a nonprofit that resources and amplifies community-led climate solutions. I'm an outdoor enthusiast. I love hiking, camping, spelunking, and adventure caving, and exploring national parks.
Oh, that's fantastic. We're going to have to put a tab on spelunking, and we'll talk about whatever that is later. And please note, this is PG-13.
Spelunking is adventure caving, just for the record. So still PG-13. Phew. And, you know, I'll share a little bit like about my background. Like, I'm originally from Jackson, Mississippi. I was raised by my grandmother, my mom, and a lineage of powerful, resourceful Black women. And my grandmother was a farmer, actually, and watching her really helped me understand that part of our responsibility is being stewards and caretakers of the land and our environment. And when we take care of it, it takes care of us. They live sustainably out of necessity. And these ways of living were really practiced by our whole community. But there are also some gritty experiences that made me acutely aware of the conditions of poverty and that I was actually poor. So all of those inequities that I grew up with really made me passionate about pathways out of it. So while I was in college, I became an intern at a community organizing institution in South Los Angeles called SCOPE, which at that time was a grassroots economic justice organization. And actually, my entree point into climate was through the economy. So back then, we were thinking about growth sectors for new and developing industries. And at that time, climate was one of those up-and-coming growth sectors. And so in Los Angeles, I actually became the organizer for the Green Jobs Campaign. But the more that I delved into climate, it became clear that climate was intersectional. It wasn't just about jobs and the economy, but it was about public health, better housing, air quality, water quality, transportation, and community resilience. And I was at SCOPE for 16 years, and I ran the organization for 10 of the 16 years that I was there. It was under my leadership that SCOPE transformed from an economic justice organization into one of the leading grassroots climate justice organizations in the country.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm picking up on from your childhood is that sense of connectivity that you talked about, nature and people, it seems to be carrying through into your work, where you might have been in one industry, but you were very quick to see that this isn't, you know, some bubble of a problem. These things are intersectional. Do you find that drives a lot of what you do?
Yes. Grassroots leaders of South Los Angeles helped me understand power, and particularly how to build it, how to exercise it, and how to wield it for good. And they helped me understand that the conditions that I grew up in and the conditions that we lived in South LA weren't just happenstance, but that people are somewhere, whether it's at a table, in a room, making decisions about our lives every single day, and they're creating these conditions that we're living in. And that we either have a choice to sit on the sidelines and reap the consequences of their decisions, or we can organize and build power in order to create change and shape and influence decisions within our own community. They also helped me really challenge the dominant theory of change, which I would say is like electing someone into office and thinking that they will save us. Because the reality is that elected officials are pulled by competing interests every single day, and particularly financial and corporate interests. So we need to be building power on the ground and on the outside and holding them accountable to our agenda, to our vision, and the type of change that we want to see in our neighborhoods. We intrinsically live at the intersections. And that, for me, underscores why climate justice is so pivotal, because it is the intersectional issue of our time. And so we have an ability to tackle racism, poverty, and pollution and build a better, healthier world.
A lot of the themes that we're getting this season from the dinner we had is the power of community coming to get what is deserved from the leaders, or at least like tell them what they're supposed to be doing, remembering that they're employees of us a lot of the time. And it's such a lost idea, the power of community, which I guess is where we end up now at the Solutions Project, which focuses on, you know, people, community, intersectionality. So can you tell us about how that works and like, what is it? How is it funded? Sell it to us. We want to get involved.
We're a nonprofit organization that both funds and amplifies climate justice solutions created by frontline communities. And we know that frontline communities are creating a more sustainable and equitable world right now. So I believe that the Solutions Project had the potential to leverage our position in philanthropy and our position within our movements for justice and galvanize and fortify resources into the communities most impacted by the climate crisis. So I took the helm, the role of president and CEO in 2020 to help materialize this vision that I had. And it was under my leadership that we made 100% commitment to justice, which was the first step to evolving our mission to popularize grassroots climate justice solutions. 100% commitment to justice meant that we needed to look at the existing disparities within philanthropy and disrupt it in a positive way, you know, disrupting forward and making sure that we're doing our part and committing 95% of our dollars to Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color, and 80% to women and non-binary leadership.
It's a lovely thought of like, another way of intersectionality is to take one community and show, hey, this community, you guys can work together to form an even bigger community. That's really beautiful. And how have you found, like, through all this work, what are some of the firsthand experiences and learnings that you've had with moving towards the SDGs that you kind of intersect with, which is reduced inequalities and climate action?
I would say, given that climate change and climate justice in particular is the intersectional issue of our time, for our SDG goals, I think centering climate justice is an imperative to accelerate a clean energy economy that benefits all people. Scientists say that we can achieve net zero, but I say that if we achieve net zero and don't address the structural inequities and income inequality and the extractive ways that we relate to each other and our earth, then we're going to repeat the harms of the past and the present day and end up right back where we started. So sustainability means being proactive about alleviating poverty, hunger, lack of affordable housing, healthcare, and other inequities in order to achieve a more equitable distribution of resources and overall good health and well-being for our society. And centering equity and justice isn't an option. You know, it gives us an opportunity to challenge and to change the unsustainable values and dominant worldviews that got us here in the first place, like individualism, competition, mass consumption, mass waste, hyper-consumerism, extraction, commodification, right? I can go on and on. And so by centering equity and justice, I believe that we have the best opportunity to solve the climate crisis for the long haul. And we can elevate sustainable worldviews and values that root in community, that value interdependence, regeneration, and care, and simultaneously achieve the global goals.
I feel like you just opened up the potential of a whole nother episode there with, I've never heard the idea of sustainable values and philosophies that's never spoken about, but that's a whole nother episode.
Yes, let's change the worldviews because that's part of the problem.
That affects what we actually do, especially now when we're going to the second half, essentially off, you know, the SDGs, 2030 is around the corner. It's far, but it's close, as we've seen, and we're not hitting the targets that we should be. So in that, where do you see the potential for
accelerated growth. Obviously, you guys have, like, your model is really great with you know, bringing communities into communities. But what else could we be doing better to make sure that we hit that 2030?
We need to be in solidarity with frontline communities and ensure that communities are shaping, influencing, and deciding what's best. We don't have time to create more harm or replicate harm. And working together, you know, talking about the needs and co-creating a shared vision and implementing that vision will save us time. We need to double down and invest in the front lines. And this means that everyone has a role to play. Businesses, I would say, should be thinking about communities. Technologists should be thinking about communities. Media, government, philanthropy. I mean, if we're not doing this work for the people, what are we doing? We know that when we put the people who are closest in proximity to the pain in the driving seat to create solutions and responses, we'll make faster progress on climate and increase community wellness, prosperity, and equity at the same time.
You see so many problems. How do you stay hopeful? What keeps you going?
The transition is happening right now, and frontline communities are making sure of that. I'm super clear that the grassroots is focused on the long term, you know, thinking about power building, infrastructure building, visioning, creating a paradigm shift in society through community-led climate solutions. And organizers here in the global north are standing in solidarity with the global south. And folks are in real time deepening relationships and building trust that's built on the work. And even though there's so much pain, fear, and hurt in the world, I have resolute faith and confidence in the transformational power of our communities and the radiating power of love that comes from our communities. Love is emanating from the bottom up, from the grassroots to the rest of society and the world. And that, I would say, is what gives me hope.
I mean, how can you listen to Gloria for more than 20 seconds and not feel we're going to win in the second half? You know, if there's people like that organizing and inspiring from such a heartfelt place of, as she said, love and hope, then I feel we will get there.
Oh, for sure. And like we started with Jesper at the corporate level and her going and showing us the power of people right at a grassroots level, who are already doing things. I think we keep forgetting that sometimes. It's like, you don't have to just be a powerful person on your own. Join in a community. I think that's a more hopeful place to be, is to immediately be in a place that's moving forward in some kind of way. And that's where we can really get some power going forward. You know, it's a slow convergence of corporate or the big power that we've always known and this little big power that we just need to tap more into. And once these two start singing, you know, in unison, the second half really can be the snowball that we need.
Well, he calls them customers. She calls it community. But all of it, as we've heard, as you say, again and again in all our episodes, is about coming together. There's a lot of people talking at the moment about the massive problem that we're in, really. If you simplify it down to a single issue, it's because we've become separate from each other, separate from nature. Mm. We see ourselves as individuals who want to gain for ourselves, whereas actually, by coming together and accepting that we are one body and one energy, then the problems slightly melt away because everyone's acting together. So I think that's, without becoming a complete and utter lie down hippie, I think we're onto something.
You can no longer look at the issues as just you. Every one of your actions is us as human beings, and I think that's it's not a great unifying factor, but I think what we unify in our power, in our ability to do good, I think that's a beautiful unifying factor. If we rise to that, to our humanity globally, it's exciting. I think we can. I think we can 2030. We should turn that into a verb. We are going to 2030.
To 2030.
That's what we're going
to do. Okay, that's what to 2030 it means. It means to come together.
It's just to come together to meet a common goal. That's what you do. That's how you 2030.
We're moving towards a wrap and a kind of I feel like we should sing it, or, you know.
Let's not. I've heard both of us attempt it. And,
okay. Let's go back to speeding it up. What's the idiot's guide to saving the second half in 30 seconds? Are you ready to do it that way?
Let us play.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Be in solidarity with frontline communities for those who are more affected by the climate change.
Because giving power to the people closest to the pain will get it solved faster.
Yeah, and everyone has a role to play.
Get communities speaking to each other.
And partners. Partnership is everything.
Look after the land and it will look after you.
Yes, because caring for the environment is good for your brand and it can be profitable.
So therefore, we should put our money with those businesses that we trust.
Join a group that's already doing. You find your power there.
And it's definitely not over yet. So let's just keep looking for opportunities.
Oh,
look at that. Time is up.
I think that's just a great way to end this tiny little itty bitty big season of ours. I've gotten so much out of this. But mostly, I think my biggest takeaway out of all of this is how possible it is. Like, it's not a second half where you're 10-0 down. This is 3-0 down, but we can do this. I think that's the biggest take out of this is the optimism is already there. The proof to be optimistic is already there.
Well, like Jan Rockström said in our first season, he said, we have turned the corner. Are we going fast enough? And I think what this little mini series has shown is there are people with whom we can join forces who are moving fast enough and teaching us how to do it. So if we take the lessons out of that, come together, you know, be brave, courageous leadership, then maybe we're going to win in the second half.
I'm excited. Honestly, I thought this statistically it was bad, but at the end of this, it's like, no, it's
reframe. It's a slow start.
Yeah, it's a reframe. Yes. It was a slow start to prove the things that we can do. And I think people have proven the things that we can do. We just need to keep on doing it now. And everybody should get on board on what we're already doing.
So do you know what I think the most important thing that we can do is that we haven't mentioned?
Uh-huh.
We can have a fourth series. So come on, people. If you can enable us to do it again, let us know.
It's the likes, it's the shares. Please do all of that.
Yeah, please do all of that. So shall we say goodbye for the last time? For now. This was Gail Galley on An Idiot's Guide to Saving the World. Thanks for being with us.
And I'm Loiso Madinga. Bye.
See you soon.
An Idiot's Guide to Saving the World is an audio production made in collaboration with Project Everyone.
The producer and sound designer is Holly Fisher. Project Everyone's producers are Imogen Fairburn and Tash Ramsaha. The executive producers are Yelene Goffin, Harry Watson and Ellie DiMartino.
If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, share on your socials and leave a review. It helps other people find us. And the more people find us, the more people are saving the world.